So tonight's topic is called Transparency and Accountability in Policing, the Oversight of Police Complaints. And so this is a topic that has generated a lot of interest. We have a shiny new report that was issued about this topic. So we are really happy to get into it tonight. So last week, CPAC released its first audit report. And this report detailed how the auditing and monitoring unit reviews investigations into complaints against police, and it included findings from their first round of audits. Tonight, you're going to hear from the Director of Auditing and Monitoring and a Senior Auditor Monitor as they describe their work and the information contained in our first auditing report. They are also going to dedicate the first portion of this presentation to providing information on the complaint intake process, as well as describing how complaints are investigated. It's important to understand that these pieces of the accountability puzzle so that our community members can be informed of how complaints move throughout the process before audits even occur. And so with that, I am going to hand it over now to Janine to take it from here.
Thank you, Talia. Appreciate the introduction. Good evening, everyone. I'm Janine Zajac. I'm the Director of the Auditing and Monitoring Unit at CPOC. I've been with CPOC for quite some time now, and I am so excited about the work we're doing. I'm really excited to share this presentation with you all tonight. If you have any questions that come up while we're presenting all this information, please feel free to share your questions in the chat, and then our staff members can read them off during the Q&A portions of the presentation. So you can send them in at any point during the presentation, and we'll get to them when we can. So I'm just gonna share my screen quickly. All right. As Celia noted, we are here to discuss transparency and accountability in policing, oversight of police complaints. So we can just get right into it. So for anyone who's not familiar with the Citizens Police Oversight Commission of Philadelphia, I thought I'd spend a second just going through our mission and some of the things that we currently work on. So the mission of CPOC is to oversee and investigate the conduct, policies, and practices of the Philadelphia Police Department. Currently, we receive complaints against police related to police misconduct. We audit and monitor internal affairs investigations and police disciplinary processes. We sit and vote at PBI panels. Those are the disciplinary hearings for police officers accused of misconduct. We conduct oversight of police shootings. We analyze police data. We develop policy recommendations and reports, and of course, engage in a lot of outreach and training. So that's a lot of things that our team works on. Tonight, we are just going to focus on how we receive complaints of police misconduct, how those complaints are investigated, and then go through the auditing process that we engage in here at CPOC. So to start off talking about complaint intake, we receive complaints from members of the public when there are allegations of police misconduct. So complaints are received at our office online, over the phone, in person. They can also be filed directly with the police department through their website, at any police district, or at internal affairs. There's lots of different avenues to file complaints. We're just one of them. The common types of complaints that our office receives, verbal abuse is pretty frequent, as is lack of service. We get a lot of complaints related to people feeling like they didn't receive proper service during a police encounter. So that can be, they called 911 and no one ever showed up. We hear that one sometimes. Also, maybe a report wasn't completed properly, things of that nature. We see some allegations of racial profiling, unlawful arrest, physical abuse, lots of different complaints come in through our reporting channels. So what happens after we receive a complaint from a member of the public? A complaint referral form is completed and ends up in our case management system. So if someone files a complaint online through our website, that complaint goes right into our case management system where we can review it and figure out what to do next. If someone calls us and files a complaint over the phone, we fill that referral form out in the case management system ourselves and work on it from there. So when we do get complaints in online, we then make multiple attempts to talk with complainants and get more information. So we don't just receive a complaint online and shoot it right off to the police department for investigation. We do as much as we can to reach out to complainants, understand their situation, get lots of information, any contact information for witnesses. We try to gather as much detail as we possibly can. This is because we understand complainants may not always decide to follow through with an investigation at the end of the day. So our conversation with them could be the last conversation that they end up wanting to have about their interaction with the officer. So as much information as we can collect and send over to the police department for investigation, that only helps the investigation be better in the long run. Once we gather all the information and collect the complaint intake details, we email a complaint referral to the Internal Affairs Department at the police department and send it to their intake unit. So they review it, and at that point they can assign it to an investigator. A note here is that if the complaint is only related to verbal abuse or lack of service, then it can be flagged for possible resolution through mediation. So the complaint mediation program is something that my coworker has been in my office has been developing for some time now and is getting off the ground. So that is another possible resolution for some of these complaints once they come in. If the case is going on to an investigation, then an investigator will be assigned at Internal Affairs. That investigator is going to reach out to the complainant and start their investigation. So that's kind of the process for our complaint intake and referrals. And I want to move next into talking about how those complaints are then investigated. So at Internal Affairs, there's a bunch of investigators who work there, and they receive new investigations sort of on a rolling basis. The type of investigation that the Internal Affairs investigators do is quite similar to any type of investigation that occurs. There's always going to be similar steps, and Internal Affairs investigations are no different. So the first part of the investigation is to collect a statement from the complainant and collect any evidence they have. So getting into a conversation with them in person, hopefully, sometimes over the phone if that's necessary, asking lots of detailed questions and follow-up questions, and collecting any video footage they may have of the encounter, so cell phone footage, doorbell footage, anything of that nature, any witness information. The investigator is going to collect all of that information. They're going to also attempt to collect additional evidence, so any documents from the police department that can help identify which officers were involved, any medical records if that's necessary for the investigation. They're going to collect as much documentary evidence as they can to understand what happened. And identifying witnesses is a really important piece of this too. There could be witnesses out there that the complainant isn't even aware of, so the investigator may then go out into the field and go to the location of the incident and try to see who may have been around at that time. Maybe it happened near a corner store. They can go into the corner store, talk to the clerk who's working, see if there's surveillance footage there, and just try to get a sense of what the neighborhood is like, who may have been around, and see if they can find anyone else who can give an account of what occurred. Once they've collected documents, evidence, video footage, and have reviewed it, they've hopefully identified the officers who were involved, and then they'll start interviewing those officers. So typically, witness officers will be interviewed first. That allows the investigator to continue to acquire information and get more details about everything that happened, and then they'll interview the subject officers last. So any officers who are accused of misconduct will typically be interviewed at the very end of the investigation, and that allows the investigator to use all the evidence that they have collected and confront the accused officer and say, well, you're saying this, but your body-worn camera footage is showing this. Explain, you know, this difference here. So they'll interview the officers, and once that's all complete, they can take a look at all the evidence that they have collected and come to a determination of fact. They can use everything that they have and decide what version of events is closest to what really occurred. They do this by using a burden of proof. So you may have heard the phrase beyond a reasonable doubt. That is a burden of proof. In a criminal case, someone has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that someone is guilty. In an administrative investigation, like an internal affairs investigation, the burden of proof is called preponderance of the evidence. So that is a lower burden of proof and just means that considering all of the evidence that's available, is the allegation more likely or not to have occurred? So sometimes it's described as a 51% standard or 50% and a feather. It's just looking at all the case, all the evidence. Is there one little piece of information that sort of pushes you in one direction or the other as to what may have occurred? So that's the standard that they're using when trying to determine the facts of what actually happened in a complaint. So once they're doing all that assessment, that analysis, they can apply findings to any of the allegations that are present in the case and in the complaint, write up their report of investigation. That report is also called a PC memo in the police department here. So it stands for Police Commissioner Memo, because essentially it's a memo going to the police commissioner for their review of the investigation. After that, it goes through the chain of command for final review, and then the case is closed at that point. So when it comes to the different findings that are possible in an internal affairs investigation, I've listed out a couple of the most common ones. So at the top, not sustained is a finding that can be applied to allegations. And that is applied when the investigator just cannot say either way what happened. That occurs sometimes in like a he said, she said situation. There's no video, there's no audio. All we have is a complainant's word against an officer's word, and there's really no way to determine either way what happened. At the bottom in green, we have exonerated and unfounded. So those are also clear determinations of fact where the investigator is saying either the allegation occurred and it was within policy, the officer acted appropriately, that's exonerated, or unfounded. That means the allegation just did not occur. They can't obtain any evidence present anywhere that shows that what the complainant said actually happened. The red one in the middle is sustained, and that is applied when the investigation is able to show that misconduct did occur. So the allegation as made by the complainant occurred and was also out of policy. The officer did something wrong. And so at that point, any sustained allegation is going to move forward into the disciplinary process. Now, in the PPD, the disciplinary process is pretty complicated. I tried to break it down into just a few short bullet points. But basically, if an officer has a sustained finding, they're going to receive a discipline charge. Sometimes they can receive training and counseling, which is not discipline. It's more of a warning that's given to the officer. If they are not getting training and counseling, they're going to get some formal discipline. They're going to have to plead guilty or not guilty to a disciplinary charge, and then it goes from there. They can either get some discipline from a guilty plea, or it could go to a PBI hearing, which is a disciplinary hearing that's held at police headquarters, and at that point a case is presented, and the panel at PBI will make a determination and recommend whether the officer should be found guilty or not guilty and what discipline they should receive. So there's a few different options there. That's just a quick sort of bird's eye view of how discipline can happen in the police department. So it's quite a process. The investigation can sometimes take quite some time depending on how able the investigator is to obtain evidence in a timely manner. And the disciplinary process can also take some time, just due to administrative backlogs and things like that. But this is a quick breakdown of how it can go and how it's supposed to go within departmental guidelines. So now that I spent a bunch of time explaining the disciplinary process and investigations, I want to drill into the question of why are investigations so important? And this is kind of the big question as to why we did this report about auditing, why we do auditing at CPOC at all. So the image that I have here on the slide, you can see, is a row of dominoes that is sort of toppling over slowly one after the other. And I put that here because I'm trying to sort of symbolize how everything that happens in the investigative stage has repercussions. So if the investigation is incomplete or improper, then that means there's no chance for accountability. So any errors that happen in the investigative stage can move forward through the disciplinary process or stop the case from moving forward to discipline altogether when maybe it should have moved to discipline. with Internal Affairs, the allegations that are brought in their investigation can then inform what type of discipline is ultimately brought against the officer and how serious that discipline is. So getting the allegations right, getting the investigation right, is really critical. Something else to note is that if an officer is found to have committed misconduct, whether or not it's their first offense can really impact how they are disciplined. So we have to be able to trust that any complaints that were brought against that officer previously were accurate and complete and thorough, because we want to know, is it really the officer's first offense? And the only way to trust that and trust the disciplinary process is to know that the investigations are all being done consistently. Essentially, the investigation is where accountability begins, and accuracy and thoroughness are crucial. So I want to pause here. I feel like I blew through a lot of information there about investigations and discipline. So I want to take a moment to check in with Danny and our team to see if any questions have come in the chat about the first slides that we just went through. Other questions we can, you know, try to address later, but anything coming in, Danny?
Yeah, there is one particular question that I think is pretty relevant. If the internal affairs investigator is not successful in contacting a complainant, what happens to the investigation?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the investigation proceeds without the complainant's participation. It happens all the time, but I think it can be difficult without having the benefit of the complainant's statement about what happened. Sometimes the investigator may have to fill in some blanks or not really end up with a full picture of what happened without a statement from the complainant. So the investigations will carry on. They just might not be as thorough as maybe they could be with a full statement from a complainant.
Another question, and I think you might be talking about this more later, Janine, was how does CPAC attend officer interviews during investigative stage?
Yeah, we can. We definitely can attend interviews, and we do. And it's part of functions that a few different people in our office serve. We do.
We just got another question. Could the interview of the complainant be duplicative of the CPAC interview? If so, how extensive is the interview of the complainant into the specific facts of the allegations in the initial interview by CPAC?
I think I understand the question. Yes, we try to ask thorough questions and get details from the complainant. And I think probably at times it can be a little duplicative of what an internal affairs investigator is going to ask. Sometimes there might be a little bit of repeating information, but I think that getting more detail is always a good thing, and we want to give the complainant opportunities to sort of give their side of the story as many times as they want to.
And then another question we have is there an average amount of time the process takes? I think assuming from beginning to end.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't have that information off the top of my head. We do report on that at our monthly commissioner meeting, so we'll report on what we saw in the previous month for how long those investigations took. So for more like up-to-date information, that's a great resource, and we have some old slides on our website from past months to take a look at. So I don't have that information off the top of the head, but it is something that we report on.
And actually, I think, Janine, in that link we said that has all the reports, they could probably read a little bit more about it in the PBI process. That talks a little bit about how long the full complaint process talks. Mm-hmm. I believe in part two, I should have some more specific information.
Yeah.
I think another question we have that is what happens if evidence of misconduct is controlled by police?
Um, I'm not quite sure how to answer that question. I think that I mean, I think that a lot of times evidence that is being obtained in regards to these administrative misconduct investigations is kind of in control of the police department, their police documents, body camera footage. Most evidence is probably going to come from within police databases and police control. But I think if there's something specific that is related to a specific situation, you know, we could try to field a question about that offline, but I think I'm not quite sure how else to answer that one.
Sure. We have a question from Council Member Bork, actually. Welcome, Council Member. Thank you so much for joining us. Referring to the final page of the explainer, it looks like the vast majority of IED allegations have not been completed. In particular, I noted that not a single domestic violence, physical abuse, or sexual misconduct allegation has been completed. And it looks like the majority of those have not have been not sustained or unfounded. This is a concerning. Can you speak more on this?
Yeah, so I think that some of the categories listed in that question are categories that don't often come in through the complaint against police process. So there are complaints against police that are made by members of the public, and then there are other internal complaints and internal investigations handled by internal affairs that relate to different types of allegations. Some of those would be domestic violence and some of the other categories that you raised. So we don't see a lot of those types of allegations coming through the standard complaint against police process. So yeah, I agree that those are egregious categories of misconduct. And so seeing some of those findings is a little troubling. And I think there's a lot of questions we have as an office about these internal complaints and how we can understand them and, you know, shed some more light on them. So that's definitely an ongoing thing with our office. And I appreciate you raising that because it is a concern.
Councilmember O'Rourke says, thank you so much. We have another question that I could probably just answer is, how long do you have to make a complaint? And for us, for CPOC, we don't have any moratorium on complaints. We'll take them. They can be 10 years ago, 15 years ago. But I will say probably the more recent they are, the better for an investigation. I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Janine, right?
Yeah, it can be difficult when if it's many years previously just due to officers leaving the department or, you know, evidence not being available anymore. So we definitely encourage people to file complaints as close as they can to the date of the incident because that ensures the ability to obtain as much evidence as possible and that officers are likely still employed by the department in order to be held accountable.
And then I think we have one more question that was in the Q&A. It says, in the report, you mentioned CPOC doesn't monitor internal investigations. Could you talk a little bit more about the process and if there is any accountability for those complaints? I don't know if you're going to talk a little bit more about monitoring or not in the...
Not really, but I think that sort of speaks to the question that Councilman O'Rourke raised about internals. Yeah, we don't have a lot of oversight over internal complaints at the moment. You know, I think, as I said before, it's something that we are very interested in understanding and you know, working on as time goes on. So I think starting with the CAPS was really important for us, is addressing the complaints that residents are bringing and understanding how those investigations are going. And so in the future, you know, understanding more about internals, I think, is really important. So I'm hearing from the people in attendance that it's a concern, and I appreciate that. And I think it's something we'll all keep in mind.
I think those are all for right now.
Great. Thank you so much for the questions, everyone. And we'll have more space at the end for additional questions and answers. So we'll get back into the report, into the presentation. I want to move now into discussing the actual auditing report. So we released it July 16th. This was the first one that we released. And it outlines the foundational work of complaint auditing, how we built that process, and reviews the findings of our first sample of audits that we completed. So this was a really exciting thing for us to release. It definitely took some time to develop our process and analyze all the data and create the report and edit the report, but I'm very proud to share it with everyone. Tonight we'll define what auditing means to us, we'll describe our process and how we do what we do, clarify why auditing is important, and then go through some of the data and some of the findings. So we can't get into everything that's in the report here in this presentation, but I know a link to the report has been shared in the chat. I definitely recommend anyone checking that out and some of our other reports about the discipline process at PPD, because there's a lot there and simply not enough time to get into it in this short presentation tonight. So what is complaint auditing? In short, it's a systematic review of an evaluation of the investigation into a complaint against police. So we do this through a series of yes, no questions. We ask these yes, no questions in every review that we do. We ask the same questions about every case because we want to be consistent in our reviews. We want to look at every single case the same and be able to answer the same questions and use the same lens for everything that we're doing. So a sample of some of the yes, no questions that we ask are, was the investigation completed within 90 days? That's a timeliness benchmark set in an executive order. And so we're tracking to see our cases meeting that timeline or not. The second example, did the investigator interview all PPD witnesses or explain why PPD witnesses were not interviewed? So we wanna see, are the investigators identifying all of the police officers who were present and could speak to what happened? And if they didn't interview them, is there a good reason why? Sometimes there are good explanations for why some officers were not interviewed, and we want to see that in the report if officers were not interviewed. So essentially, we're checking each investigation for quality, thoroughness, and objectivity. Of course, we want investigations to be of high quality and be thorough to make sure that they're doing the best job that they can. And objectivity is really important. That's a cornerstone of any good investigation, is objectivity, being able to look at the facts through a neutral lens and come to objective findings about what happened. In addition to that, we also collect other data to help us understand more about these complaints. So we're checking and collecting information on the location of the incident, demographics of the individuals involved, the involved officers, so we can see who's showing up multiple times throughout these cases, and also the timeline of the investigation. We want to see, not only was it the investigation completed within 90 days, but was it sitting on a supervisor's desk for a really long time after the investigation was done, waiting for a signature? So checking that out and understanding all of these different facets of an investigation, that all adds up to a complaint audit at CPOC. So why is this important? Within CPOC, what we have found is that work of one unit in CPOC informs work of the other units. So as our team is looking through these reports, looking through these complaints, we can refer issues to other CPOC units for additional work if we're seeing any patterns. So for example, if we see a handful of complaints about warrants being served at wrong addresses, then we can flag that and say, maybe this needs more attention, maybe something's going on, maybe there's a policy issue at play here that we want to address and resolve so that this type of complaint stops happening and people are not being affected by these warrants being served improperly. Again, if we spot a recurring theme or trend, we can create explainers or infographics or documents that are public facing for residents so that they can maybe understand some policing issues that are impacting them. So for example, a couple of years ago, we were seeing a lot of complaints or a lot of things out there about Miranda warnings, people saying they were interacting with a police officer and they weren't given their Miranda warnings. So we created some documents to show what is a Miranda warning? When should it be read? What does it mean to have that read to you? So understanding where there may be gaps of knowledge with our residents and being able to be a resource and share the information with them. And then not only is it important for CPOC to do auditing, but for policing and oversight in general, it helps bring transparency to a process that hasn't had consistent outside reviews before. So internal affairs investigations, well, they've been going on for years and years and years. There hasn't been a lot of transparency to how they do what they do and what's happening in those investigations. So shedding light on that and bringing a civilian perspective to those investigations is really important. To speak a little bit about our auditing process itself, I wanted to touch on how we developed this. We weren't sort of pulling this out of thin air. This was a very deliberate process and figuring out how to make this a really sound data collecting sort of endeavor. So we looked at other agencies that are out there doing similar work like this. We looked at the Council of Inspectors General on Integrity and Efficiency. It's a very long name, but they have some great resources for peer review of closed investigations and closed cases, and that was a great resource. Also, the City of Chicago Office of Inspector General, their public safety group, does quite similar work to this, and so using some of their established processes and their lessons learned was really useful in our development. And we also took a good look at police department policies, their Office of Professional Responsibility policies and their guidelines for investigations, and just seeing what are their rules for investigations so that we can understand, are they meeting their own rules or not? And to talk a little bit about auditing moving forward, you know, the audits that are included in this report that we released last week were all done related to cases that had already been closed, where investigations had been done and finished, and we could only do sort of an after-the-fact review. Moving forward, we're actually developing a whole process that allows us to conduct these audits on investigations before they are signed by the chain of command at the police department. So this is a very, very new development, and we're in the very early stages of this, but it's a very exciting step for CPOC because it means we are able to impact investigations while they are still ongoing. So we can add our perspective, find any errors that we may find, and tell them to basically make the investigation a little bit better and a little bit more thorough based on our feedback. So that's very, very exciting for us, and it's a big deal. So this also will allow us to make larger recommendations based on trends in real time. So if we're seeing a pattern of certain types of things present in investigations, certain types of allegations that maybe aren't getting attention that we think they should, we can make a larger recommendation in real time and hopefully address the problem in real time. And I just want to take a moment to sort of celebrate that new development in oversight in Philadelphia, and in the context of some of our recent accomplishments at CPOC. So in May of 2021, we released the first collaborative reform report related to PBI, the disciplinary hearing process at PPD. As a result of that report, we were able to get civilian oversight staff at the disciplinary charging process to have oversight of that. We were able to get auditing into the active investigation space. So that has all happened since May of 2021, just 3 years. And those are things that were pretty much unthinkable just, you know, 5 years ago in oversight in Philadelphia. So this is really exciting time for us, and I'm really, really proud of our team and everything that we've been able to accomplish. And I'll stop bragging about us now. So before we discuss the data from the report, a couple of things to note is that the cases audited for this report are a snapshot in time and not representative of all IED investigations. So that's important to keep in mind. Some of the investigations in the sample by now were completed a few years ago. So the data we collected was very useful for us in several ways, but our audits couldn't impact the investigations or the cases until now, as we're moving into this new version of auditing. And all of the work in the report represents a learning and a building process. We work to ensure consistency across our reviews, but we've continued to tweak our process and try to evolve and make our process as sound as it can be. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Kimberly Crane, our senior auditor monitor. She did some fantastic work on auditing and on creating this report. Could not have done any of this without her, so I felt it was appropriate for her to have some time in the spotlight and share some of these findings. So, Kimmy, I'm going to turn it over to you whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Jane. Good evening, everyone. My name is Kimberly Crane. I am a senior auditor monitor at CPOC, and I will be discussing the data results of our first auditing report. So for the investigations that are analyzed in this report, these cases were received by CPOC between March 2022 and June of 2022. And in total, we reviewed 250 complaint against police investigations, also known as CAP investigations. These cases involved 479 PPD personnel. And in total, there were 652 individual allegations that were investigated. And so many investigations had multiple allegations present in one case. So we were able to generate a chart showcasing the concentration of misconduct allegations across different districts in the city based on our sample and analysis. And so we found that the districts with the highest number of allegations were the 15th, the 24th, the 25th, and the 18th. And this is only for misconduct incidents that were reported. And so there's always the question of, is there less misconduct in the other districts, or is it not being reported? And so this type of analysis can help us identify outreach opportunities and contacting other districts in the city to make sure they know about the work that CPOC does and about internal affairs and the complaint process, as well as these results are reflected from the sample that we conducted of cases. This may not be representative of all IAD cases as well. So here we have a total breakdown of the allegations present in all of the investigations that we looked at in this sample. And so the most common category of allegations present in this set was departmental violations. And that encompasses a number of different types of misconduct that can include improper search and seizure, missing property, failure to activate body-worn cameras. Also a common one is PPD directives violation, which there are obviously many directives, so it really encompasses a number of different types of misconduct. The second most prevalent type of allegation was a lack of service. This can involve failure to provide proper service, failure to accurately investigate a complaint, things like that. And it goes down in order of allegation and how many were present in our data set. So in this graph, we were able to show for each allegation across all of the investigations what the outcomes were for each type. And so what really stood out to us, for example, was that for civil rights complaints and for physical abuse complaints, there were zero sustained allegations among all of the cases that we looked at. And so with knowledge like this, we can ask questions about how these investigations are done. So for example, for civil rights complaints, we have noticed that there isn't a consistent practice of how these allegations are being adjudicated. So for example, some investigators will do an analysis based on the district of occurrence of this incident and compare the number of, for example, stops and the racial breakdown of those stops compared to the racial breakdown of that district. Other investigators will focus on the actions of the complainant and whether it warranted the action in that individual experience as opposed to looking at it structurally. And so we have had questions about the consistency of investigations like that. And so we're going to continue to monitor and make recommendations based on this and have an ongoing dialogue with PPD about this.
Yeah, and I just want to add something here to go off of what you were saying. The physical abuse category is highlighted there, and as you mentioned, there's zero sustained allegations. So seeing that was startling for us, and so it allowed us to again ask questions of the department and say, you know, what are these physical abuse investigations looking like? And we're learning that not all physical abuse investigations are done through the complaint against police process. They have an internal force investigations process for incidents that don't arise out of complaints against police, but are force incidents that are flagged through their force review process. That's all done internally. So we're trying to figure out how we can develop a project to take a look at some of those investigations so we can shed light to the public about physical abuse investigations, how they're being done and how they're being adjudicated and what the findings are, so that we can just have some more transparency around that. Because if you look at this chart, you see, wow, zero sustained allegations of physical abuse. They're not holding anyone accountable for physical abuse, and that may not be true. So we want to really understand what's going on there, get more information so that we can be open and transparent about what we're seeing there.
Yeah, thank you, Janine, for that. And I also wanted to add that for some of the allegations, for example, for lack of service and verbal abuse, there's also the outcome of complete, and you know, we have it color-coded here for the different types of outcomes that Janine explained earlier. And complete is also for police officers who haven't had a lack of service or verbal abuse allegation made against them for 2 years. And so if they have a lack of service or verbal abuse allegation made against them, they have a separate type of investigation done by their commanding officer, and they receive basically training and counseling. And the outcome for those investigations is considered complete, which is why only those two areas have that light blue color coding there. So in our auditing process, we have divided the module in four different sections. And the first one focuses on timeliness, the speed at which the investigations are conducted. And so there was an executive order signed by the mayor in 2017, mandating that internal affairs investigations are completed within 90 days. And so we have been evaluating the internal affairs investigations based on this metric. Recently, we understood that internal affairs has reinterpreted this policy to be 90 business days instead of 90 days. And so we have shifted our evaluation of newer cases based on that. But for this subset from 2022, we evaluated based on the 90 days. And so some areas of improvement that we noticed in this section, only 25.6% of investigations were completed within the 90-day benchmark, and 75.7% of completed investigations were signed by an IAD inspector within 30 days as required by IAD policy. So when an investigation is completed, it has to go through a chain of command in the police department of signatures of different people and rising ranks reviewing and signing it. And that obviously delays the process even more. And so there are benchmarks for when documents are supposed to be signed. And so we would like to see that benchmark improved over time. Additionally, in 39% of cases, the significant gaps in investigations, such as delays between interviews or delays in closing the case, were not explained by the investigator. And we also observed that the police commissioner memos, the reports that we review, were completed in a timely manner in just over half cases, 58.2%. And we evaluated that metric by comparing the date of the last interviews conducted by the investigator to the actual completion of the PC memo and evaluated that timeline accordingly. So this is an area that is really important to build accountability and trust within the community, that especially given that there has been a long-standing backlog of investigations at Internal Affairs, which was exacerbated by the pandemic and a lag in being able to conduct interviews. And so as Internal Affairs is getting through that backlog, we want to emphasize the importance of prioritizing the speed and obviously not compromising quality, but increasing that as well. And just as a note, PPD reports recent improvements to the timeliness section of their investigations, which CPOC will continue to monitor. So in terms of progress on the timeliness section, we have done some data analysis based on the more recent audits that our unit has been conducting. And so between August 1st of 2023 and March 31st of 2024, the audit monitoring unit conducted 231 audits of closed Internal Affairs investigations of complaints against police, as well as 23 between May 23rd of 2024 and June 24th of 2024. And so from the first date set of those 231 audits, based on our analysis, the investigation was completed within 90 business days as updated from the policy, 32% of the time, and not completed within 90 business days, 68% of the time, which is consistent with the findings in our report. However, in this even newer data set, in terms of the investigation completion times, they were completed within 90 business days, 70% of the time, and not completed 30% of the time. So there has been some improvement shown. And again, we're going to continue to monitor this as we audit more and more cases over time. So the second section in our auditing analysis module is professional standard of care, which discusses the investigator's decision-making in contacting the complainant and witnesses, as well as designating the allegations present in the complaint. So what went well in this section based on our analysis? The PC memos clearly articulated the incident that occurred and gave the reader a clear picture of what happened in 94.8% of cases. And in 90.4% of cases, the investigator exhausted all resources to identify the police officers accused of misconduct. And this is really important because many times complainants aren't able to identify exactly who the officer is that they had an encounter with, or multiple officers. And so it is up to the investigator to determine who the complaint is focused on. And so that can involve using information from the complainant and doing some other side work, like looking at the district and the shift dates of who was working certain shifts in certain areas, demographic information provided by the complainant, and so forth. So it's really important, obviously, that the specific police officers are identified so that discipline can be rendered. So it's great to see that in the vast majority, these police officers are being identified. In terms of areas for improvement, in 81.2% of the cases, the investigator made required attempts to identify, locate, and contact all civilian or non-PPD parties, including all potential witnesses. And so, according to IAD policy, investigators have to make the following contact attempts to complainants and witnesses, and that includes an email, at least one documented phone call, IAD form letter sent by certified and first class U.S. mail, as well as a written message delivered by a uniformed officer if they're in Philadelphia. And so this is really important for getting the cooperation of civilians as well as the witnesses. This is really important, especially for when we have cases that are he said, she said, and the only way to really determine whether something occurred objectively is having independent evidence. And so auditors evaluate the contact attempts made by investigators when, especially when complainants aren't cooperating with an investigation and haven't agreed to have an interview, we see, did they do all of the required contact attempts and check that off. And so that was happening 81.2% of the time. We'd obviously like this to be better. It's important to make sure we do everything we can to get all objective parties cooperating. In addition, 12.5% of investigations included language that suggested a lack of neutrality. This could be a number of things present in the case. A common one would be providing negative information about a complainant that an officer in the encounter would not have known, and maybe in an attempt to justify the behavior, as well as a tone shift in terms of a positive tone or positive framing when talking about the officers. And so this is obviously something that we have flagged and are in collaboration and communication with the police department on, and it's something that we are going to continue to monitor. So progress on the professional standard of care section. So for cases included in the original audit report, the investigators made those required attempts 81.2% of the time, and that statistic has remained the same in our recent audits. And sometimes the PC memo states that only some of the attempts that are required were made, and in others, it doesn't clearly state whether all potential witnesses were identified or contacted. And as I mentioned before, these independent witnesses can make a big difference when determining facts in an investigation. So it's really critical that all of the contact attempts are made. And as we can see in our updated audit analysis, the required attempts were made 78% of the time, so it's a little bit less, but it's about the same. So the next section in the auditing module is evidence collection / analysis and interview. So this is looking at the thoroughness of the investigator's collection of evidence, their analysis of that evidence, the thoroughness of both the interviews and the interview summaries in the police commissioner memo. And so what went well in this section? In 94.7% of cases, the analysis of the evidence was thorough and inclusive of all relevant documents, interviews, and other information mentioned elsewhere in the PC memo. And in 95.1% of cases, the investigator interviewed all PPD witnesses or explained why PPD witnesses were not interviewed. And this is important because we want to make sure that IED investigators are being consistent across both civilian witnesses as well as PPD witnesses. And it's great to see that PPD has also provided explanations when officers were not able to be interviewed in that small subset. So areas for improvement in this section. In 79.9% of the cases we reviewed, the PC memo indicated that the investigator checked for the existence of all potential audio and video evidence, including body-worn cameras. So this is one of the most important pieces of the investigation, especially if we have a he said, she said type of case where there isn't much ability to adjudicate the claim unless there is some type of independent evidence. So it's really important to ensure that the investigators are exhausting all avenues for this. So that could be if this happened outside of a shop, it could be a shop camera footage, it could be street camera footage, it could be traffic light footage, etc. As well as in 86.6% of the cases, the investigator requested this audio video evidence within an appropriate time frame. And so a lot of these types of evidence have retention periods where the evidence, before the evidence is deleted. And so it's really important that these investigators are trying to obtain this evidence as soon as possible. We are aware that some of this can be out of an investigator's control, such as if the complaint is filed much later after an incident initially occurred, Obviously, that an investigator can't help if it is past the retention period when they receive a case, which is why we really encourage community members to file a complaint as close to the event or as close to the incident as possible to ensure that types of evidence like this can be obtained. And so we want to boost this metric because this really ensures that more accountability is reached and that we can get definitive findings of fact in these investigations.
Something I want to add in here, Kimmy, the stat that relates to the PC memo indicating that the investigator checked for the existence of all possible audio visual evidence. I want to note here that just because they didn't note in the PC memo that they didn't check doesn't mean they didn't. And so we want to make sure that when investigators are taking the steps to check for all the evidence, that they're clearly documenting that so that any reader who comes across this PC memo can be sure that the investigator is, you know, checking off all those boxes and looking for all the possible evidence that they can. So it's going back to that consistency piece, that thoroughness piece, and making sure that they're really explaining their work and how they get from A to B to C in their investigation.
Yeah, thank you, Jane. So in terms of going back to a progress update on this section, so for cases included in the original report, this obtaining of audio video evidence within the retention periods was 86.6% of the time. And this has slightly improved. More recent audit analysis, the investigator's control can make it difficult or impossible to obtain it. So we're just encouraging that whenever possible, they are worth doing, exhausting all efforts to obtain the evidence. So the final section in the auditing analysis module is conclusions and case dispositions. So this is reviewing the outcomes and the decisions made by the investigator based on all of the evidence that the investigator was able to collect. So what went well in this section? In 91.6% of cases, the allegation findings on the conclusions page were logical and reasonable based on the analysis of the evidence presented in the PC memo. So this piece is related to of the evidence that the investigator was able to find, the corresponding allegations and the conclusions were logical and reasonable. This might not reflect evidence that was missing. This is of the evidence that was obtained. Some areas for improvement in this section. So 51.1% of PC memos included a clear and concise statement of law, rule, or regulation that was allegedly violated or formed the basis for the investigation. So something like this, we are curious about for consistency's sake. We want to make sure that all investigations done by internal affairs investigators are being done the same way every time. And so if half of the investigators are including these types of rules and half aren't, you know, we want to reconcile that and we want to make sure the policies are consistent throughout. And in 77.5% cases, all allegations identified during the course of the investigation were addressed on the conclusions page. This is also a really, really critical piece of the investigation. So if a complainant alleges that a police officer committed X, Y, and Z violations, and in the conclusions page of the investigation, the investigator only addresses X and Y allegations, Z is just not present, it's not going to be formally addressed, as well as on the officer's disciplinary record. Even if it isn't proven, these allegations would be present on an officer's record, especially for later on and later offenses to be referenced. So it's really important that all of the allegations that a complainant makes or that are just identified throughout an investigation as more information is obtained, that they're all being addressed, as well as for buy-in and accountability for the complainants themselves, because obviously complainants want to feel that if they're addressing their complaints with internal affairs, that every component of what their concerns are being addressed. And so this is something that is a high priority for us. And as a note, 34.4% of investigations sustained only administrative violations. So administrative violations are more procedural violations related to, for example, that an officer filled out paperwork incorrectly or didn't fill out paperwork, or that an officer didn't turn on their body-worn camera when they were supposed to. So these are types of violations that are being discovered through the course of the investigation and aren't the focus of the investigation. They're more secondary. And so almost a third of the investigations, the only sustained allegations were these types of violations. So progress that we've observed on this section. So in the original report, all allegations and violations present were given a finding 77.5% of the time. And in our more recent audit, we've observed that that statistic has actually gotten worse in recent audits. It has gone down to 62% of the time. And again, trusting that investigations are complete every time is critical to building accountability with community members. So this is something that is really important to us, and emphasizing that investigators are including every component of a complaint made. So we also were able to identify the specific types of allegations that were being missed by investigators, and we were able to conglomerate them into, you know, the highest incident rates. So the types of allegations that were missed the most by investigators were unprofessional conduct with a subset of rude dismissive behavior. The second most common was a departmental violation, improper stop and detention. And then the third was departmental violation, a PPD directives violation, which again can encompass a number of different things. For example, the unprofessional conduct allegations being missing emphasizes the importance of having civilian perspectives in these and oversight in these investigations, because members of the community might, you know, read a description of an incident and notice unprofessional conduct, and members of the police department may disagree and see something as a component of policing. And so we may disagree over what is considered unprofessional or rude, and it's important that our perspective is incorporated into these analyses. Again, also having a number of improper stop and detention allegations missing is related to the Fourth Amendment, and this is something that we are interested in, as well as improper search and seizure.
So I think that concludes our data presentation related to the report. I wanted to take a moment and just discuss what's next for auditing in our office as we continue to do this work. So we will continue to do these audits. We do them every day, and now we are able to do these audits with access to case file materials. So that is really going to change the game for auditing and allow us to have more impact on how these investigations are proceeding. We're going to continue to share updates about our reviews at our monthly commissioners meetings, and hopefully release some more cumulative reports about our work and the data that we're able to collect and the outcomes are of our audits. We're going to hopefully be able to make some really good recommendations in real time to internal affairs about individual cases that we're reviewing, and also any trends or themes we're seeing across investigations, and then we can track responses from internal affairs about those recommendations. Some of our goals are to review as many of these CAP investigations as possible, continue to advocate for consistency across all investigations into police misconduct, and help ensure that investigations are solid when they head into the disciplinary process. That'll help ensure that officers are being held accountable when appropriate. And, you know, the topic of arbitration is a pretty hot topic. We read news stories about officers who faced pretty serious discipline and then had that discipline overturned at arbitration. We want to make sure that investigations are not the reason why discipline is being overturned at arbitration. If we can ensure that these investigations are following procedure and are really thorough, we're hopeful that we can see some sort of change to these cases that are being overturned at arbitration. That might be a lofty goal, but it's certainly something I've had in mind in thinking about audits and the impact that we could possibly have someday. And of course, the ultimate goal is to increase accountability. We want to make sure that officers are held accountable. We want to increase some transparency around some of these processes and continue to share information with our community members. So before we move into our Q&A portion, I want to say a huge thank you to Kimi Crane, who you heard from, all of the hard work she did on developing auditing and her extraordinary work at CPOC in general. Kimi, thank you so, so much. To the CPOC auditors and monitors who helped build this process, in addition to Kimi, Jeff Hussein, who is now one of our investigators, Damon Green, who was one of our original auditors and has since evolved in his role into the outreach unit. They were so helpful in this. And our current auditor monitors on the team, they are doing fantastic work. I have an amazing team, and I'm so excited to see what we can do moving forward with this. So moving on to our Q&A section, Danny, Jody, if anything has come in, I'll do my best to answer questions about everything that was in this presentation. There is a lot here. So thank you all for your attention and time, and I'll do my best.
Awesome. So we have a few questions. First says, you mentioned in the report that IED sends the memos to CPOC for auditing. Is there any sense if they are sending the complete information, or is they cherry picking cases to share that may or may not have some of the serious allegations for CPOC to audit? So I think they're asking a little bit about, how do we know, are they sending the full picture, or are they picking which ones we get to audit?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think in conversations with leadership there, you know, the understanding has been that everything for related to CAPS comes to us. You know, I think figuring out a way to backstop that or double check that process and make sure that we are receiving a complete picture of everything is, you know, can't be a bad idea. But at this point, I believe that we are receiving what they are telling us that they are sending us, but, and that's just based on the professional relationship that we've been able to develop over time and the collaboration we've been able to have. But I think that's a fair question and something that we can keep in mind moving forward.
Another question we got, which I don't know that we'll have the answer for, is does ID have to share who the police officers are to the complainant once they've been identified who the officers were? So like if someone files a complaint, they don't know the officer's name, do they reveal that information to the complainant?
So something I can mention is that anytime someone files a complaint against police and an investigation occurs, the complainant should receive a letter at the conclusion of the investigation that says, these are the findings of your investigation. And then if you have questions, there's contact information for who to reach out to about the investigation. So I know that they do let people review their case files and their investigation. So I believe some of that information would be included in the any, you know, version that they allow a complainant to review. So I don't think that information would be a secret, but you would have to follow up with internal affairs because they are the people who hold those files and who would be like in charge of that review process.
The next one we have is in the areas for improvement for professional standards of care, will you monitor whether lack of neutrality ever rises to the level of a civil rights violation?
I think when we are monitoring a lack of neutrality, we're really monitoring it on behalf of what the investigator is putting in the report. So we're looking at sort of the professional conduct of the investigator as it pertains to the investigation they've done and the language that they're including in the report and how they are presenting their analysis. So, you know, I'm not an expert, but to me, I don't know that they're that civil rights comes into that sphere. But I think as far as lack of neutrality goes, we're looking at just sort of what's on the page of the investigative report.
Another question is there a code of discipline for violations, or are all violations subject to interpretation? I mean, I think the answer is they have that discipline code.
So Internal Affairs has a list of allegations that they use to classify any misconduct complaints that are coming in. And so they're going to take information that's coming from a complainant and then fit it in to these different types of allegations that are present in their hierarchy and in their sort of list of possible allegations. So things fit in there, and then they use police department policies to then decide whether or not misconduct has occurred. So there is like a set list of allegations that they use, and I think that's sort of an administrative necessity in order to classify and organize all of this information that comes in. So I think there can be some lack of clarity within some of those allegations, and that's definitely something that we have on our list to approach and try to understand and see if we can clarify and get some clear guidelines for how these allegations are applied.
Another question we have is, and we might not have the answer to this, do you have a percentage of findings and or discipline that were changed to a lower finding or reduced to discipline at arbitration?
I don't have that information. I know there's some information related to arbitrations on various city websites. I don't have that statistical information like ready to go. So unfortunately I can't really address that one.
Sylvia asked this question, even though this is not your responsibility, have you notice any patterns with any auditors regarding bias for or against police?
No, I really haven't. I mean, I think that we spent a long time developing our auditing questions to be really objective, and they're really just like collecting facts about the investigation. So there really isn't a lot of room in there because we're critiquing the investigation itself, not necessarily the conduct of the behaviors that are present in the complaint against police, if that makes sense. So we are focusing on how the investigation is done, how investigators are doing their work. Are they being logical? Are they being neutral? So it's really about the investigation itself.
Awesome. Trying to see, I think that might have been all of our questions. Just double checking. Yeah, I think those are all the questions that we got. Thank you everyone for those wonderful questions.
Okay, are we ready to go ahead and close out for the evening? Okay, all right. Listen, thank you so much, Janine and Kimmy, and shout out to the auditing and monitoring team. Several of them, the whole team actually is on tonight. Thank you for such a very, very detailed presentation about all of the amazing work that you do. I'm just so happy that, you know, our attendees this evening were able to learn more about your unit. If you were not here tonight and you happen to be watching this, maybe tomorrow or another day in a recording, please share this with your friends and your networks and contacts, because this is information we definitely want to make sure gets out into the community. Don't go anywhere just yet. I just want to tell you about a couple of upcoming events that we have going on here at CPOC. So on the 25th of this week, that is on Thursday, the CPOC outreach team is going to be participating in a NACO webinar. That is the National Association for the Civilian Oversight of Law Enforcement. The webinar is going to be talking to other oversight agencies about strengthening stakeholder relationships to increase community engagement. That's on Thursday. On July 30th, the outreach team again is going to be in Washington, D.C. at the Mandela Washington Fellowship Summit. This summit brings together young African leaders who are being paired with agencies and organizations in the U.S. to build their professional development. CPAC always gets a Mandela Washington Fellow. This year, we will be joined by Sherelle Lauti. She is a forensic psychologist from the Seychelles Islands. She's coming and she'll be here for the entire month of August. So stay tuned. We'll have photos and keep the public abreast of some of the exciting things we'll be doing with her while she's here. On the 5th of August, CPAC will be celebrating Public Safety Awareness Month. There'll be a big kickoff celebration that's going to take place in Love Park from 1 to 3 p.m. That is on August 5th. And last but certainly not least, on August 13th, we are having a huge community discussion that we're really excited about. August 13th at the Venice Islands Performing Arts Center. We're going to drop the flyer in the chat in our Eventbrite link. This discussion is going to be about traffic stops and policing. We are going to be joined by Valerie Castile. She is the mother of Philando Castile, whose case made some national attention a few years ago when a St. Paul police officer shot and killed Philando during a traffic stop. She is the founder of the Philando Castile Foundation. She's going to be joining us to talk a little bit about her son's legacy and some of the work that she's doing in the community. We're also going to be joined by Jacqueline Carter. She is the director of the Alliance for Safe Traffic Stops. And Jackie is also the creator and inventor of the Not Reaching Pouch. This is a pouch that affixes to your car vent, and you can hold your license, registration, some other driving documents in it so that everything is clearly visible and nobody has to reach for anything. We're going to have some of those pouches available for our attendees. So again, that event is August 13th at Venice Islands Performing Arts Center. We're going to have some friends stop by and give some reflections, talk a little bit about the subject, which is traffic stops and policing. So we'd love to see you. Please join us. Hit that registration link so that you can let us know you're coming. But we'd love to see you. And until next time, our commissioner's town hall will be on August 6th. I did forget to mention that. 6 p.m. on Zoom. As usual, we'll send out information about that. So we'll see you at one of those events. And until then, take care, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. And just so you know, the website has all of our links to the Zooms for the events as well as calendar information. Thank you for joining us.